Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Peach State Pandemonium, a production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com, where we take you down memory lane for a look at professional wrestling the way it used to be, with conversations from those who paved the way. And now the GWH Radio Network presents Peach State Pandemonium.
Good evening and welcome to Peach State Pandemonium for Thursday, October 17th, 2013. This is Michael Norris, and alongside me are Jerry Oates and Bobby Simmons. How are you guys doing this evening?
Bobby said he was doing great.
I'm doing wonderful. I have no complaints.
Let me tell you something, Mr. Oates. Last Monday, it was early Tuesday morning. I get this call at 12:15 in the morning. And I'm just panicked because it's from Bobby, and I'm thinking, oh, Lord, what's happened now, and who's it happened to? And he pocket-called me going home from the soccer game.
I figure time's up. Everybody ought to be up. Sitting through that misery.
Oh, that's right.
Oh, geez, that's awful.
Well, what is their record so far this season?
1-4.
Well,
they were off last weekend, so that was a blessing. They couldn't lose.
Yep, it could have been 1-5.
Yeah, and now they play Tampa this week. Well, everybody's hurt. We don't have a starting wide receiver available Sunday.
Hmm.
Bobby, you're a regular down there. Go suit up and try out.
I heard that, brother. Some of them guys that are playing, you know, I could probably slip in. They wouldn't know the difference.
Bobby Refrigerator Simmons.
I got news for you. Wait, some of them guys hit each other. I ain't real sure everybody's smarting everybody up.
Yeah, you could walk on the field and ask the guy on the opposing line, do you know how to work?
Yeah, are you smart?
So evidently y'all aren't.
Oh, what's happening in the wonderful world of Tybee Island? Anything?
It's quiet now. Last weekend was wild, but it's over now for the summer, for the rest of the year.
Yeah, I guess Columbus Day was the last holiday, huh?
I had Pirate Fest down there this past weekend.
Oh, really?
Yeah, had cops go through plate glass windows and everything else.
wasn't it last year that somebody in a pirate suit did something? Tried to rob a store or something?
There's no time. You can't believe grown people actually do that. It's amazing what alcohol does to people.
Yes, it is. They'll make them dress up, a grown person dress up as a pirate, and your name's not Johnny Depp, then yeah, something's wrong with you.
Yeah, exactly. It was about 11:30 last Saturday night, and I was walking down the street with one of the cops. He's big cop, big old arms and all. It was crowded. And I was walking toward the street side, and he was walking toward, you know, the buildings on the sidewalk. And some guy out of the crowd reached and grabbed me. Now, I don't know who this is. You know, I don't know how many people done it. He said, you want to wrestle? Well, I reached across with my right arm and almost snatched him out of his boots. He said, I work for the city, man. I work for the city. You don't know whose people got swords on them.
Yeah.
God.
Oh, man. The lively goings on in Savannah, Georgia.
They look for reasons to throw a party and get drunk down there, don't they?
Yeah, it can rain and they'll throw one, Bobby.
Maybe the Falcons ought to move to Savannah. That'd be like the Saints were years and years ago. People show up just for a reason to get drunk. It don't matter whether
they're
in
or not. Yeah, exactly.
Or
Exactly.
Do they still have the semi or the minor league baseball team down there, the Sand Nats?
Yes, they do.
I bet they get drunk at their games.
They get drunk at that.
Oh, man.
They got gnats in the beer and everything else. They don't care.
I know neither one of you guys were a big drinker, and I never was either. But I used to absolutely hate to work in buildings where people where they served beer. I hated it, especially working here.
Do they serve beer at the circus?
No.
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 It never bothered me with them selling beer in the big buildings, but them little small Athens. Son, them people, you'd see pocket knives going to the ring before the first match. I mean,
and they were cutting each other.
I mean, one of the worst rides I ever got in my life was up there, and it was the fans fighting. It wasn't even us.
But see, that's what I'm telling you.
Yeah. I mean, it was, oof.
So that building you guys used to work in here in Valdosta, I'll be in it next Thursday.
Oh, the Mathis Center?
Yeah, the city's having a health fair for the city employees, and they're doing a circus thing, so they requested I bring the clowns there. So I'm borrowing them for a
day. Well, either Bobby or I could show up. You'd have a clown on you.
Well, if you guys can find some size 18 shoes and come on down.
Well, working in that building years ago, you felt like a clown some nights. So. Ooh.
So I'll take pictures and send them to you guys. Bring back some fond memories to you.
Jeez.
Well, tonight we're going to continue what we did last week, and hopefully I got some more names that you guys can talk about, tell stories about, tell lies about, whatever you want to do. But
can we be truthful this week?
Yeah, you can be truthful all you want. Most of them are dead, so you're not going to hurt their feelings. So I take it back. No, not most of them are dead. Some of them are. A couple of them are, let me put it that way. And the rest of them, they live far away, so I don't care if you hurt their feelings or not. But anyway, I'll cue up a commercial real quick. When we get back, we'll start on the list. So let's pay some bills real quick.
Wrestling fans, Anarchy Wrestling Television tapings are the second and fourth Saturdays of every month at 4236 Level Grove Road in Cornelia, Georgia. For more information on Anarchy Wrestling and on the shows to watch the television product and a whole lot more, go to anarchy-wrestling.net. That's Anarchy Wrestling, the second and fourth Saturdays of every month in Cornelia, Georgia.
If you're hurt, get the money you deserve. If you're in pain, get the money you deserve. At Terry and Peterman, we're personal injury attorneys who take a professional, thorough approach to your accident and injury claims. Don't call some long-distance law firm or satellite office. Don't trust your claim to just anyone. For a free consultation, call the law office of Terry and Peterman today, 229-247-0386, or go online at www.terryandpeterman.com. The law offices of Terry and Peterman, making things right.
Whether you're having an autograph session, personal appearance, or live event, we got just the person you need to contact for all of those needs. SBI Bookings is home of some of the best stars in the wrestling industry today. They provide you with the best talent this business has to offer, from Kevin Nash, Larry Zbysko, Scott Steiner, and many, many more. So who will you contact next time you're planning an event? The men of SBI Bookings. Check them out at sbibookings.com.
Do you remember Tommy Rich? What about Ray Gunkel or Gordon Solie? Can't get those nasty Anderson brothers out of your head? Well, you can catch them again at GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com. Who was on the first party you attended? Who was it under that mask? Remember the first Omni Spectacular or the big main events at the Bell Auditorium? That happened in Columbus on my birthday. Find out at GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com. Whether you want to get back some of your past, or maybe you just want to find pro wrestling in your area, check out GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com.
All right, we're back, and before we get into this, since he's listening, I'll ask you, Bob, you mentioned before, just before we went on there, what in the world is Charlie Smith doing in Nashville?
He is up there because Vanderbilt plays Georgia this Saturday, and he has to go get his license/permit to be a street vendor tomorrow, and he's going to go up there and be kind-hearted to them folks in case it rains. I'm sure he's got about 10,000 ponchos and different paraphernalia that he's going to hand out to them people to keep them getting wet.
Yeah, I'm sure he's going to donate that for nothing. Right?
Well, he's too good. He's too good a fellow.
Donate it for $12, $15 a piece. Oh, man.
Yeah, he called me today and offered me a free ride to Nashville, but unfortunately I was tied up.
Well, he could have stopped and picked up Gene. He was going that way anyway.
Yeah,
Gene,
well,
tired,
I don't think Gene likes to spend the night part.
No, not when you might wake up in the middle of the night with Charlie bouncing on his bed watching Tarzan movies in his underwear.
Jeez.
That's enough to cure anybody from that.
I'll never forget going to Savannah. Me, Charlie, Larry Nichols, and Charlie's friend John Gibbs, one we call Bogus. And we got there on Thursday, and we went. Mr. Newman had two rings that he was going to sell Ann. He had an 18-foot ring and a 16-foot ring, and we was going to buy the 16-footer for the TV station, and I forget, the 18-foot for the auditorium in Atlanta or something, I don't remember. But they wanted me and Larry to go down there and look at them, see how hard they were to put up and take down, you know. And, of course, I think Jerry told me Mr. Newman's son built those things. They were great rings. And they were all, you know, they were like one piece. I mean, the pieces were however long the ring was, it wasn't broke down into a million pieces, so it was very easy to set up and take down. But we got there, and we were working there Friday night. Well, Friday morning, I guess it was, I don't know, 10, 11 o'clock, me and John Gibbs rode to the airport to pick Ernesto up, who was flying in, and on the way back, John told Tom, he said, "I'll bet you $100 when we open the door, Smitty will be sitting there either in his underwear or naked, watching a Tarzan movie." And son, that's exactly what he was doing. He was sitting like an Indian chief in the middle of the bed, didn't have nothing on but his underwear. And son, we opened the door and he started beating his chest and yelling like Tarzan. If you ain't ever seen that, everybody ought to be entitled to that at least once.
I'll take your word for it, sir.
But he's a huge Tarzan mark. If there's a Tarzan movie on, I remember a few years ago they came out with that toy where they had that Tarzan action figure. Son, he's got one. He's got one at home.
Well, let's get started on our list. First name on the list, worked in Georgia. Best known as former NWA World Junior Heavyweight Champion, Ken Mantell.
I was around Ken a lot, but I never worked with him.
Where were you around him? I know he worked in Portland. So, but
he wasn't there when I was there.
You went there. He was in Georgia. Who was it he teamed with in Georgia? Was it Tom Jones?
I don't know. When was he here, Bobby? Do you remember?
Mid-70s. I refereed a lot of his matches, but I don't remember who he teamed with.
Seemed like he held the Georgia belt with somebody. I don't remember who it was. It wasn't a very long time. Did he work in Georgia much when he was a junior heavyweight champion?
Not that I remember. He came in. He stayed here 3-4 months, maybe 6 months max. But he was a... I mean, you know, a heck of a worker, but I don't remember him getting. I mean, maybe he did hold the belts. I don't know. I just don't remember him getting that big a push around here. He was always middle of the card when he was here.
Where is he now?
As far as I know, he's in Texas. I want to say around San Antonio. I don't know.
I hadn't seen him in years.
He came into Mobile. He was in Mobile a lot when he was a junior heavyweight champion. He was there probably a dozen times or so. And then after he lost the junior heavyweight belt, he came in and was the Gulf Coast champion for several months in 77. But it was after you had already come and gone, Bobby.
Yeah.
When he was there. But he had shaved his head and was bald, and he had a thing. He had a cowboy hat, like a Hoss Cartwright type hat, with a wig sewn in it, and he'd wear that to the ring and then take it off and wrestle bald. And evidently he did that a couple of different places. But from what I understand, he turned out to be a good booker. He booked for Britt some, he booked for Watt some, and turned out to run some decent programs while he was a booker. But I never wrestled him. I saw him work several times. In fact, they had a rare match in Mobile, Jack Briscoe against him, when they were both world champions, and it was for Briscoe's title. And they worked about 40, 45 minutes, and Jack went over on him, but that was a great match. He can always work heel in Mobile, but, you know, he was a scientific-type heel. But that was a great match. That was two good workers. Now, I don't know what Ken's background was. He broke in around not too long before you did, Jerry, because he worked in Mobile and in Florida under his real name as Ken Lusk. Just opening card.
That's where I first knew him as Ken Lusk.
But he was a good worker, but he just he wasn't big in Mobile until he came back as junior heavyweight champion, and then he had several programs with Baxter, and he had several programs with Lucas and everything. So, but he was a good worker. And the next name on our list got his start in Georgia. That's Ricky Steamboat.
Yeah, he did get started there.
Didn't he work? This wasn't the first place he worked, was it? Didn't he work somewhere before we came here?
I think he worked in Florida.
Well, he worked some in Minnesota because he went through Vern's camp.
Yeah, he went. Yeah, so he may have, but he was.
So he worked some
up
there, and then I think he went to Florida and then came here.
Right. But I don't remember when he first started using the Steamboat name. It probably was in Florida because Sam Steamboat was such a big name in Florida that probably pushed down.
Yeah.
Or they pushed him, his son's Sam's son or his nephew or younger brother or whatever it was, and that's where I think he acquired the Steamboat name.
Yeah. Yeah, he got his. He worked. Yeah, when he first came here, he hadn't been working long, but he came in here again. At the time he was here, we had a bunch of people who were just, you know, getting started. He was here same time Orndorff was here. Scott Irwin, Richard Blood, Tito Santana, Mercedes Solis, whatever
right.
name he was using.
You know, that's Ricky's real name, Richard Blood.
Yeah. Barnett.
Yeah.
Barnett actually flew to Ricky and me were talking about that in Vegas a couple years ago. Barnett actually flew to Charlotte and asked him if he had any problem with giving that name to Tito Santana. Because when he came here, that's what he worked as, was Richard Blood. But he did all right here, you know, again, just middle of the card, opening matches, and then he went to Charlotte, and that's where he got his break there.
Well, here's a bit of trivia for you. Remember in 76 when Barnett was thinking about buying the Mobile territory.
Uh-huh.
You guys went in and worked in Dothan. Ricky was one of them.
Okay.
And then he came back and worked one other time just in Dothan with a couple guys out of Florida. they came in and did a mixed part. Well, speaking of Tito Santana, that was the next name on my list. I know Tito had a couple runs in Georgia. He was there as Richard Blood, as you mentioned, early in his career, at the beginning of his career. Of course, he broke in, Blanchard broke him in, because he was a teammate at West Texas State with Tully. And so that's how he got in the business. And then he came back in 81, 82, something like that, as Tito Santana. He'd already been in New York.
Yeah.
And had the world belts with Putski, and then came back to, was in Georgia, because he was around Georgia when, or was working in Georgia when I was around doing jobs on PBS. Never worked with him, but what a smooth worker he was.
Yeah, he was, of course, I quit refereeing, was in the office when he came back second run. The first run, yeah, when he first started, I refereed a lot of his matches when he was first getting started, because he was on the spot show circuit with me. But, God, what a mess of talent there was back in those mid-70s here.
Yeah. Well, another name. Yeah, and he's in Pennsylvania somewhere, isn't he, Jerry?
Somewhere
Philadelphia
up there.
Or somewhere up there. Another name on our list, or the next name on my list, was always in the shadow of his older brother, because of his older brother's accomplishment, but was a tremendous talent himself, and that was Jerry Briscoe.
Yeah, he was. He lived in Jack's shadow, but he made a lot of money up in Charlotte.
Yeah.
Him and Thunderbolt.
Yep.
Yeah, Jerry's a nice guy.
They had to work with Sweet Hansen and Rip Hawk for 2 years solid. Well, Bobby's got who was it that Jerry was working with that you said something to him and he went wild? And,
oh, that was...
Oh,
he was in a tag match. He was in a tag match. He was working... I can't even remember who his partner was. It might have been Rocky Johnson, because I think they put the Georgia belts on him and Rocky Johnson there for a while. But they were working with Nikolai Volkoff and Lorenzo Perini. And Lorenzo Perini's a funny sucker anyway, you know, and we were in the ring, and he grabbed a headlock on Jerry, and he hollered, "Crisscross, drop down," and they went into the crisscross, and Jerry dropped down, and when he did, Lorenzo pounced on him like a cat, and when he did, I dropped right down in Jerry's face and said, 2 points, and next thing I know, the other four of us was on the standing on the floor, and the Oklahoma Indian was on the warpath in the ring.
I can see that happening.
Oh, God, he was running in circles screaming. Perini looked at me and said, "Are you getting back in there?" I said, "Not till he calms down." Yeah, and he had bought some points in the office. He was technically one of the bosses. God. Another thing he did one night, he did this to Rocky, but it was just we were somewhere, and him and Rocky were partners, and Rocky is scared of frogs and lizards and stuff like that, and somebody caught one in the dressing room. I think Jerry caught it, and he found out Rocky was scared. I mean, literally would blanch. He wouldn't get near it. And he took it in the ring and gave it to one of the heels and told the heel what was going on. So Jerry purposely ran to the ring and got there first. And the two heels jumped on him and was just beating the crap out of him. And here comes Rocky out of the dressing room running toward the ring to make this big save and come back. And whichever one, I can't remember who it was, but they run their hand down in her pocket or trunks and pulled out this lizard, or I can't remember if it was a lizard or a frog. And when he did, Rocky just stopped. And they beat the crap out of Jerry, and Rocky just standing on the floor, and the people are going, "Why aren't you helping him?" Every time he'd make a move, they'd hold that thing up.
God.
Yeah, Jerry's a funny guy. He was a Tampa Bay Buccaneer fan, and we used to have this running. He'd call me when Tampa would win, and I'd call him when the Falcons would win. And this thing's went on for years. I would even email him in New York when he was working for.
You didn't talk much, did you?
No, we didn't talk a whole lot. But then Tampa messed around and actually won a Super Bowl. So I had not seen him. I had not seen him for years, and he come to Vegas 2 years ago. And he was sitting at a table, and I walked up behind him, and I said, you know, there's two things I can't stand. One's an Oklahoma Indian, and the other is a Tampa Bay fan. And he never turned around. He went Bobby Simmons.
All right, next name on the list is another one of those that in the mid-70s was in Georgia doing, opening card, middle of the card matches, but went on to have a tremendous career. Bob Backlund.
I saw a tape of him today. Him and Inoki.
Really?
That he was the strangest worker I had ever seen.
Who, Backlund or Inoki?
Backlund. I mean, I know he was a great amateur and all that, but I don't think he ever got over anywhere except in New York.
He never did here, and they tried.
He was pretty popular in Florida just before he went to New York. In fact, he was recommended to Vince Sr. by Eddie Graham and Vern Gagne. But he was so different for up there because they never had wrestling. Even their babyface champions weren't wrestlers. You know, they punched and kicked, and, you know, you going from Bruno Sammartino and Pedro Morales to Bob Backlund was quite a shock, but he was definitely over there, at least for the first couple of years he was there. I think the problem with him in New York was, and of course, neither Pedro or Bruno were great interviews either, but they had the ethnic population on their side, the Italians for Bruno and the Spanish for Pedro Morales. But Backlund, his interview skills never got better. I mean, even when he tried to portray himself being mad at somebody, it was, you know, he still stammered and stuttered and all that stuff. But once he got in the ring, he was tremendous to watch. Now, you say weird as far as how he worked?
Yeah. Just his style. I mean, he was, you know, he got it. Was going to make a comeback, he'd do his feet up and down like a mad little boy. And then when the people start calling the world champion, how he did he? I mean, come on, man. You've heard it.
Well, one thing I've seen him do that I've never seen anybody else do is have somebody have him in a figure four arm bar, and he stand flat-footed and lift them straight up onto his shoulder.
Oh, he was strong.
The guy
strong,
had to been tremendously strong.
Oh, he
was you ever around him, Jerry?
Yeah, do leg raises all night long in the dressing room.
Do leg raises, sit-ups. He would get, he would lay down on a table, and he would do them, you know, put his feet on the floor and bring them up, you know, and do this crap. This is before he went in the ring. And then after he come out of the ring, he'd do another set of stuff. I mean, he was just,
he was strong now.
He was a strong kid. We found out he was addicted to popcorn. And he was working with Ronnie Garvin one night in Athens. And you know how those dressing rooms were? The Heels was over next to the concession stand. And, Babyface was on the other side. And Garvin came through the shower. And, you know, the shower was right between the dressing rooms. He came through the shower and he stuck his head in the door. And he went, Bobby, come here. And I said, okay. And I walked over. He had three bags of popcorn, and he said, feed this to him. He said, I don't care how you do it. He said, feed it to him. He said, I'm going to blow him up tonight. And I went over, and he was doing them leg raises. He was laying on a table, and every time he'd raise his legs, I'd put popcorn in his mouth. And he ate three bags of popcorn. I mean, I stood there and fed it to him, and that's the only time I ever saw him blow up. Ronnie Garvin rode him that night. I mean, rode him like a pony. Would not let him catch his breath.
I just hate that so many people think of him now as when he came back in the 90s and did that goofy gimmick for Vince. And he goes around dressed like that all the time now, keeps his hair cut and a buzz cut, and wears that goofy bow tie and hollers and screams and acts all goofy. You know, for him to have been the WWF champion for 5 years and been the style that he used then and the character he was, which really wasn't a character at all. You know, most people think of him as that goofy gimmick, and that's what, when they put him in the Hall of Fame last year, that's what he came out dressed like. Instead of being Bob Backlund, he came out being a goofy character. Of course, maybe the goofy character is really him. I don't know. I never was around him. But I was always a fan of his work, though. I like the way he worked. But you're right, he did, when he did his comebacks, he'd jump up and down and shake his fist. Like he was pitching a tantrum. All right, this is somebody I know you guys have both been in the ring with, Stan Hansen.
Oh, I love Stan to death. I loved him to death. But poor fella, and don't think he didn't make a fortune in Japan. He made fortune. I was over there many times with him. But Bobby, I don't know if you ever wrestled Stan.
Never did.
I know one night I was on all fours coming up. He kicked me in the head. I thought my head would spin around like the Exorcist. I thought he broke my neck. Yeah, he take those glasses off, you were in trouble.
Oh, yeah.
But Stan was a good guy. He was a great guy. Just a great guy. He worked hard in that ring, too.
Yeah, he was, you know, Stan's a devout Christian, and how he put up being Ole's partner all them years. I mean, we'd be in the dressing room, and Ole's going to one of his rampages, snorting and cussing, and, you know, Stan just get walk out. And, but he was, yeah, he'd take those glasses off, man. He didn't know where all depth of perception was gone.
He worked hard. Stan always worked hard.
Yes, he did.
I met him.
He made you work hard, too, if you went to
work. I worked hard trying to stay out of his way.
Exactly.
That's what I was working hard, staying out of his way. He was in Florida when I started. He was starting at the same time.
Yep. He was almost skinny. I've got pictures of him from his early days in Florida.
He wasn't near that big. But that boy worked. I mean, he worked hard.
How many years has it been since he was in Mobile, Michael? Five, six?
Five, I think.
He came to the reunion
one
year,
time.
Jerry, and he had lost so much weight. I mean, he was thin again. He looked great. He looked great.
I thought the world was thin.
Yeah.
Did he go back to Mississippi, Michael, or is he still in Colorado?
Oh, no, yeah. I don't know if he's in Mississippi or Colorado. The last I heard, I think he was in Colorado. He's got a son that's either college, big college player, or maybe even pro by now. I don't know. But I think it was baseball, wasn't it, instead of football?
I don't know. I knew he had a kid in college. That's why he was in Colorado.
Yeah.
But somebody had told me he came back to Mississippi.
He may have. That's odd. Between he and Ted DiBiase, out of all the places in the world they'd pick to live, both of them chose Mississippi. Maybe they know something.
Well, you can live cheap there.
Yeah, you can.
Well, I've heard. I've heard if you only got 6 months to live, move to Mississippi. It'll seem like a lifetime. So.
That's a good one, Bobby. I've never heard that one.
Oh, man. All right. Here's one for you guys. And I'm interested to hear your take on this gentleman, Tommy Rich.
Go ahead, Bobby. Bobby.
I like Tommy. I've never had a crossword with him. But it's a great example of getting too much too quick and not knowing how to handle it.
And self-destruct.
Yeah, that's a good way to describe it. I haven't seen, last time I saw Tommy was about, I don't know, it's been a year or two since I saw him. I see his wife. She attends a church that a friend of mine pastors, and I see her periodically, and I ask about him. But he's they're living in Griffin, Georgia, and he had the world on. It was given to him. I mean, it was handed to him, and he didn't have a great body. He wasn't the greatest worker in the world, but it was just something about him, the looks, the charisma, whatever it was, that was just, when he smiled, the room lit up, and that's just, and Barnett seen it, and when Barnett saw it, he knew he had a star there, and it went from there. But I think self-destruct is a good way to describe it, because that's kind of what happens.
Yeah, but he was definitely, for a period there, I'd say from 79 to 81, you couldn't touch him in Georgia. He was the most over person in Georgia.
You couldn't touch him anywhere that cable went.
Well, that's true.
I mean,
how do you think he would have done, like, in the Carolinas or Florida?
There again, I guess it would have been all dependent on how they pushed him. All things being equal, if you had just, he would have been. And again, I'm not trying to be overly critical, but I honestly think, based on his work and he would have been middle of the card, maybe.
I agree with that.
I mean, and I'm not trying, again, I'm not trying to be overly critical. I got nothing personal against him at all. I like Tommy, but he was in the right place at the right time.
That sums it up right there.
Yeah, I mean, they teamed him and Ricky Martel together. Now, you compare Martel's body to Tommy's body. There is no comparison. You compare their work. There is no comparison. But yet, like you say, Michael, Tommy was so over that there wasn't going to be another babyface. No matter what they did or how hard they pushed, they couldn't get over him because he was that over.
Yeah. Well, you think
the only one he came close
along
was wrestling, too.
Yeah, and that was a different type of over, because you think when Tommy came along, of the long history of the Georgia territory, he was the first teeny boppers type, that the girls would come out and see
him. Ate him up. That's what it was.
Yep. I mean, wrestlers who had a different set of fans. No.
There's nothing wrong with that.
Well, that's what Barnett said. And I know I've told this story before, but he was working for Gulas in Tennessee, and Gulas sent him down here. We were getting 2 to 3 guys a week to come from Tennessee to Georgia to feed to Abdullah. This is when Abdullah had first got in here, and we were feeding fresh meat to the lions is what we were doing on TV every week. He was just killing people, but we didn't want him killing our own people because, you got to use them. So, it's one week Jerry Barber and Buddy Wayne came in, another week it was somebody else and somebody else. Well, this particular week, Barnett happened to be at the TV station, and it was Tommy Rich and somebody else. And Barnett walked in the dressing room and saw him. And he turned around, and he came back out, and he told Tom, he says, do not let that boy wrestle on TV. He said, put him out there for an interview. He said, I don't want him to open his mouth. He said, you sit him out there at that table with somebody else doing an interview and just let people look at him. And that's what they did. And Barnett went home and called Gulas and did whatever they did to get Tommy out of up there and bring him down here. And the rest is history.
Yeah, and for those who still insist on the rumor, let's clear that up right now. Barnett was not after him and did not offer him the NWA title and put the NWA title on him for any kind of sexual favor. That rumor will not die, no matter how many times it's been killed.
It will not die. You know, no, that wasn't the case at all. They put that title on him to give him some credibility. And he only held it 5 days. He never appeared on TV with it. He worked Augusta where he won it. He worked Macon. He worked Columbus. He worked Athens or Rome. I can't remember where. I think he worked Rome. And then on Friday night, he was in a spot show in Gainesville, Georgia, in a civic center that would hold about 1,500 people if they were hanging from the rafters. And that's where he lost it back to Harley. But it was done to give him credibility. And it could have, and this is my opinion, it could have made his career even greater than what it was if he had just been smart enough to leverage it.
I think it killed his career, basically.
Well, it may have.
He started going downhill in 81. I mean, he really started going down in 81. He went back to Tennessee, and then he turned heel. He never worked heel in Georgia, but he worked heel in Tennessee, and just, you know, he wasn't a good heel in my opinion, because his biggest strength was the sympathy he would draw, because he'd take a beating. He was like Ricky Morton. He'd take a beating, and his big draw was he wouldn't quit. He'd keep coming back.
And that's, Bobby, what's he done all these years?
What, Tommy?
I know he works here and there, but you can't live on that.
That's all he's doing, as far as I know. That's all he's doing.
My God.
All right. Well, the next name on the list is, we just mentioned, Mr. Wrestling 2. Was there ever anybody in Georgia for the length of time that he was over as he was?
No.
No.
That's not even up for discussion. I don't think, anyhow.
There was a period in the 70s, from 74 to 78. All you had to do was put his name on a poster in a spot show, and you were going to draw $2,000 to $3,000. Didn't matter who else was there. If you put his name on a poster, you were going to draw.
Now, that gimmick was a Leo Garibaldi creation, was it not?
That's correct.
Was Wrestling 2 a Garibaldi creation?
Yeah, that's what I've always heard.
Hell, it was. Him and Leo were very, very close friends.
Yeah, I've heard John talk about Leo was probably the greatest booker he ever worked for. I heard him. He told me that many times.
So I always thought that. A lot of guys didn't think so. I thought he was.
I've always heard he was. I never had the pleasure of working for him, but I've always heard how great he was. He kept a book with pages of finishes, and he'd go back and pull a finish that he'd done in Los Angeles as a worker, you know, 30 years before, or 20 years before, I guess, and use it, and it was always over. But that gimmick was done with Tim Woods' approval, since he and John worked together so much. Because I know they were friends when they were both in Florida in the early
70s. They were like best friends. They were like brothers.
Did you ever work with Johnny Bobby?
No, never did.
Did you, Mike?
Oh, yeah. I caught that knee on more than one occasion.
That was
Stan Hansen's lariat. Johnny was snug, and he loved to work.
He was snug. Yeah, he very snug.
He'd grab you in that front face lock and take you down on the mat and rub your face I mean, he wasn't doing it maliciously. He was never that type of person. You know, he never took advantage of, or at least he never
did
with me.
No, he didn't.
But he was snug. He was snug.
He was very snug.
But nice
he was some kind of
I always loved being around him.
The nicest. He was a nice man. I don't know how he's doing
about,
now. I heard he's not doing real good.
Jerry, I talked to him when he was here. He was here about six weeks ago, or maybe a little longer than that now, but I talked to him a couple times. He said he's doing well. He sounded good.
He did.
He said his health was doing good, and he said he felt good, and everything seemed to be going well. So he's back in Hawaii now. He said that he told me before he left, he said that his plans are to be in Vegas in June for the Cauliflower Alley Club, so I'm hoping to see him in June. But I made a lot of miles with that fella. You could travel
did
with him and you didn't have to worry about going to jail for something.
Did he drive fast?
Oh, geez. You know, the only time he ever scared me, though, he had a, during the time that I knew him, he had an Oldsmobile 88, a blue 88, that he had them leopard seat covers in. Did you ever see that one?
I rode in that car.
Okay, you know, and on the front of it, it had two headlights on each side, and where the bright beams used to be, he put aircraft landing lights in there.
My car like that.
He could like light up the sky. Oh, you did too?
Yeah, I had a Buick. It had the four headlights. Oh yeah. They'll think people won't dim their lights for you.
Oh yeah. And then he had a Cadillac. Well, he actually bought it from Miss Olivia, but he would drive it periodically. And then he had an Oldsmobile 98 that he eventually sold to Bob Orton Jr. But near the end of his run here, he had a Volkswagen Rabbit. The only time he ever scared me was riding with him in that Rabbit. Son, that Rabbit, he would run that thing 90 and 100 miles an hour.
I know he would.
And that, you know, I sat over and closed my eyes, and I told him, I said, John, I said, I'm not going to sleep, bud. I said, you're scaring the hound out of me. And he'd just laugh and keep on going.
Oh, he drove, man.
Yeah, you didn't. You
now,
didn't
I heard.
There wasn't any grass grew under your feet.
No, sir.
Well, I heard the story. I can't remember who told me. Is when I was. It had to be Mike Jackson, I guess, when we were going back and forth to Atlanta TV. But two was so over in Atlanta. You know, he never took his mask off. Supposedly, from the story I heard, and he got stopped by a rookie policeman that didn't know who he was somewhere close to downtown. I don't know if it was on 75, 85, where it was. But the guy called his supervisor, and his sergeant or whoever it was came there and chewed the cop out for stopping. He said, that's wrestling, too. He does whatever he wants. But that's how he was.
Oh,
I mean,
yeah.
He would sit in the dressing room. He would sit in the dressing room at TBS. With his mask on and his glasses poked through the eye hole so he could read the paper.
but
he was something.
He would. We were coming home from Griffin one night. We had made the loop. We had worked Atlanta TV and Columbus TV and Griffin, and you know that was a long day. I mean, any way you shook it, it was a long day. And we left Griffin, and we're both give out. And he was driving. He was in that 98. Or in that 88, and we come up through there, and I looked in the side mirror behind us, and I told him, I said, you know you got a car on our tail, and he goes, yeah, I've seen him. And boy, he was hot. God, he was hot. And we couldn't lose him. Coming up 1941, you had all them traffic lights. Well, we finally got to 138 where we turned left and went over through Riverdale and went out toward where he lived over in Union City. And that road was very crooked and curvy, and, I mean, we got over there, he lost them. I mean, he was flying up through there. And my car was parked there at 85 and behind the gas station where we always parked. And when we pulled around behind the gas station, I told him, I said, take that mask off, let me have it. And I said, you sit right here till I get gone. And I put the mask on, got in my car, and pulled out to go get on the expressway. Well, as I turned out, here the two people were following us. It was a boy and a girl. They seen me. Well, they hung a U-turn. Well, I called him on the CB and told him he could go home. And I rode up 85, and I probably rode half a mile or whatever, and they were beside me. Well, I turned my inside light on where I could be sure they'd see me, and I reached back like I was fooling with a string or something, and they pulled up next to me, and I raised that mask up and smiled at them. They was two mad people. God, they were hot. They done drove 100 miles and hadn't seen nothing but the referee.
When you guys were started doing the northern tours, didn't he have a problem at the airport? Somebody tried to go in his luggage and pull his mask out?
Oh, geez, that happened in Savannah.
You had to
run like a devil to catch that last flight out of Savannah after we worked on Sundays. And me and him were together, and we just got out of a cab. And we started up there, and I threw my bag up on the thing, and he towed it a silver Halliburton. And he threw it up on the conveyor, and they went through, and my bag come out, and I grabbed it, and I started up, and he hollered at me. He said, "Man, stop them. Don't let them leave." So I'm walking up the thing going toward the gate, and then I hear him cussing, and I turned around, and some little smart-aleck agent had opened that suitcase up right there on that table in front of God and everybody. He was mad. And the only reason the guy opened it is because the guy thought he knew who he was, and he was just going to prove he knew who he was. Because he didn't have anything in that bag other than his boots and wet towels and a mask. And trunks.
All right, yeah, next name on the list. Oh, go ahead, Bobby.
I was just going to say, him and Jody Hamilton were probably the two people, and Tom Ernesto, they were probably the three mask guys that I was around the most that really, really, really protected their business.
Their
people thought they knew who they were, but they never were absolutely 100% positive.
What did Debbie say? I heard her
she was talking about Tom and Jody used to stop at a gas station and buy gas from this fella that ran a Texaco station. And he sat on the front row in Atlanta, and he cussed them every week. I mean, just cuss them like dogs. So finally Tom had enough, and they got in the ring one night. And the guy had no clue he had no idea who they were. And they stopped there 3-4 days a week. And they got in the ring, and Tom walked over to the ropes, and he told Jody, he said, "There he is right there." And the old guy's going, "Yeah, that's here I am." He said, "Yep, that's the guy that works at the Texaco station." No, boy just backed up and sat down.
He probably thought twice about every car that pulled in there.
I'm telling you. Well, I mean, you think about, Tom looked like a lawyer. He looked like anything but a wrestler.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Jody, you could see him being one, but not Tom.
Yeah, I mean, Tom just, he always dressed immaculately, and he wore high-dollar clothes and shoes, and, he was so well-spoken and soft-spoken, really, when he wasn't, around the guys. He just, you would never imagine.
All right,
this was a guy everybody wanted to kill.
Yeah. The next name on my list is another one that probably was a case of too much too soon. But he was another one that was a huge draw in Georgia for a few years anyway, Tony Atlas. Did he first come to Georgia as the Black Atlas under the hood?
Yes.
Was that just in the Carolinas he did that game?
No, he was here.
Was it?
Yeah. Did you ever have the privilege of working with him, Jerry?
No. Been partners with him. He showed up in Kansas City when we were out there in 74 and 75. Wasn't there long. I mean, wasn't there long at all.
Well,
and it was a long time before I saw him again,
Well, trust me. I had the privilege, and I did it enough for both of us.
Really?
No, I worked with him when he was Black Atlas. He was under the hood. somebody didn't show up in Carrollton one night, and they sent me over there. And he was snug.
Was he really?
It wasn't a snug like you think snug, though. I'm sort of like, I guess I was like Frank Hickey with you. Excuse me, sir. Has anybody told you about this thing we're doing here?
Yeah, but at least he wasn't Zulu bad.
Oh, no. And he got better. He did. He got a whole lot better. Tony was a good guy, but you're right. Too much too soon, and probably the same words that Jerry used for Tommy would go for him. He sort of self-destructed.
Yep.
Yeah. But from all things I hear, he has discovered that he's self-destructed, and he's a much humbler person after being homeless for at least a year. He's married a woman that has helped him get his life back together. And you think of all the guys that in the early 80s that were so over, and, you know, let's be honest, most of their money went to drugs, partying and drinking and everything else. But at least he's...
But, you know, I always like being around Tony. You know, he wasn't a wise guy or anything like that. Yeah, he was fun to be around.
Nice guy. You're right.
Yeah.
He was.
I never had any problems with him, you know, like being a loud mouth in the dressing room. He was just a fun guy. He was.
Yeah. Yeah, you're absolutely right, Mike, about he's I saw him a couple of years ago, and I guess it was the last time I saw Jerry's brother Ted, too. He came over to the matches that night we were in Macon. And I went down there to specifically see Tony, and Abdullah was there, and I hadn't seen him in a long time, and I went to see both of them. And Tony was me and Tony talked before the matches started, and he told me he married a German woman. He told me at that time she was 80 years old. She was like 15 years older than he was, or a little more. And he said, "This woman saved my life." He said, "She straightened me out. She got me off of all the stuff I was on. She said she takes care of me." And she says, "If I get out of line, she tells me." And he said, "She saved my life." Yeah, and he told me he was sleeping on park benches.
Mm-hmm.
He lost everything he had.
Is he living in New Jersey, Bobby?
He's up there. I think he's in Maine.
Oh, yeah, maybe it is Maine.
He's in Maine. But he is, he very humble guy. But, you know, he's one of those guys that he got hooked on some stuff he didn't need it to be on. He was – Barnett had him on a $1,200 a week guarantee, which was a lot of money back in the day. He had the – they did a deal using tapes out of Atlanta where they worked him against Harley Race in Houston, Texas, for Paul Bosch. Bosch paid him $3,000 for a Friday night in Houston. And he called the office on Monday morning and told me what he had paid him cash money. And I called Barnett and asked Barnett, you know, do we give him the $1,200? Do we give him what he actually made? And he said, "No, our deal's $1,200. Give him $1,200. And I said, "Okay." So he made $4,200, or he was given $4,200 in a matter of 3.5 days. And I'll never forget handing him his check that Monday morning. He turned around to leave the sports arena. When he got to the front door, he kicked it and kicked the door off the hinge. And the last thing he muttered when he went out the door was, "You just can't make any money in this business."
No,
so,
he did not.
You know, he was on stuff he had no business being on. And I talked to him about that in Macon 2 years ago, and he did not remember that happening. But Randy was sitting there when we were talking, and Randy said, "Bubba, you did it. I was there." So, I guess it's good. Some things you can't remember you did, but I agree with you, Michael. I think he's got his act together now, and he seems to be doing well. He still looks good.
Yeah, he does. Well, from videos and pictures I've seen of him. If anything, his arms are bigger now than they were back then. And
yeah.
He was huge back then. God, he was huge. All right, the next name on our list, Jerry, you probably worked around this gentleman more than Bobby did, even though he did have at least one semi-lengthy run in Georgia, but it may have been when Bobby was still working with Ann. And that's Roger Kirby.
Yeah, I worked with Roger quite a bit. I'm trying to think when that was.
I think it would have been at least your times in Kansas City, because he was a mainstay out there for years.
Yeah, he wasn't there when we were there. He might have come in a little bit, but I worked with him mostly here in Georgia.
Really?
When did you go to Kansas City, Jerry, the first time?
74.
Okay, well, see, he was here. When I went to work for Barnett in November of 74, he was still here, because that's where I first met him.
Yeah, he seemed to follow. He and Harley got to be real close somewhere along the line, and he seemed to follow wherever Harley had the book, Roger would work there.
Roger was a good worker, man.
Yeah.
Yes, he was. Yes, he was. Have you ever seen pictures of him when he was young, in the early and mid-60s, when he first got in the business? Have you ever seen pictures of him?
No, not that I know of.
He is the absolute spitting image of Buddy Rogers.
Really?
Absolute spitting image of him. When he came into Mobile, he and Les and Dennis Hall all came into Mobile doing the cousin gimmick. You know, they did that in Georgia, and they did it in Florida, and they did it in the Carolinas. And I've got pictures of him when they were in Mobile, and he looks just like Buddy Rogers. Buddy Rogers was his idol anyway. And that's who he had.
He was a very good worker, man. Very good worker.
Didn't he set some sort of bench, or not bench press, but leg press record at some point?
He could have.
He recall that at all?
I don't doubt that.
Yeah, he was another one that was deceptively strong. He didn't look it. Just to look at it, you wouldn't think he was that strong. But he was a strong guy and a great worker. And a great heel. And if you ever listen to his interviews, he talks like Harley. You close your eyes and think you listen to Harley. He sounded
like
Harley.
Yeah, he did sound like Harley, yeah.
All right, here's
let me throw one other thing. We need to
keep
Mr. Kirby in our prayers.
Yes.
He has Alzheimer's disease, and it's progressing pretty rapidly. He's in pretty bad shape.
Is he in Kansas City?
I saw him. Last time I saw him was 3-4 years ago in Las Vegas, and he was just starting to get the. He was just starting to get the early stages of it. He was with his wife, and she told me that, you know, he sometimes forgot things. But when we were in Tennessee, it was mentioned that he wasn't doing real well.
And, I hate to hear that.
And on that note as well, Dennis Hall is in a nursing facility in somewhere around Tupelo, we think. And he supposedly, it's a rehab facility, but he supposedly is working, trying to get well enough to come home. So
he had a stroke, isn't that right?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, he had a stroke.
My God.
Yeah, it's amazing. Out of the three of them, Les is still in good health, which I'm grateful for. And Les still keeps himself busy. I think he's back out in California.
He's in Knoxville.
He's in Knoxville.
No, he's going to be in Blue Ridge, Georgia. He's doing a clinic this weekend. Yeah. Up there for Woody.
Well, if he's going to learn from somebody, that'd be a good one to learn from.
Yep.
You don't believe me? Ask him. He'll tell you. I love Les to death. I love him.
Les is a great guy.
All right. Next name on the list. Bobby, I know you worked around him. Jerry, I don't know if you ever even though he was a mainstay in Georgia for many years. I don't know if you were ever around him, but Argentino Apollo.
A little bit. Not like Bobby.
He was, he worked for Ann almost the full 2 years, or maybe it was the full 2 years we were in business. I can't remember if he was still there at the end or not. He may have given it up by then. He quit to paint full-time. He's a great artist. And, I imagine
but
if he had something by him today, it might even be worth something. But
he didn't live long after he quit, though. Didn't he die, like, within 2 or 3 years of getting out of the business?
I'm not...
No, he died young.
What happened to him?
I heard he had a heart attack.
Yeah, that's what I've always heard.
But he was living here in Atlanta somewhere, and he was painting full time. He worked after he left Dan. He went to work. He worked for Einhorn for a while when they were trying to do that deal, and then that was the last place I knew he worked.
I think so. And that was in 75.
He was a referee's nightmare to be in the ring with. I know that. Because he thought he was being funny, but he'd middle you in a heartbeat. Guy'd get him down on the mat and put his foot on his throat and be choking him, and you'd go to you'd argue with the guy and get the guy to break, and finally you'd start your count. He would hold the guy's foot on his throat where the guy couldn't move his foot. So you either had to disqualify the guy or break your count. Well. Of course, we'd break the count, and people scream and yell, and it made us look like we were idiots. And until Tom happened to see him do it one night, and he told me to disqualify the guy next time he did it, and I did, and that kind of ended it. But it just, that kind of stuff. And him and...
Did he draw any money, Bobby?
No.
I didn't think he would.
No. The only time he ever drew any money, I think, was when he... And, Mike, you probably better know this than me, but didn't they team him up with Rocca in New York at one time?
Yeah, they
might have drew some money
Rocca,
together. But
yeah, Rocca was trying to, break away from the New York office, and he eventually started his own, but it didn't last very long. But Rocca's first replacement in New York was a guy that, Jerry, I know you probably worked around him. I don't know if he ever worked in Georgia or not. Zuma, the amazing Zuma, or mighty Zuma, or Argentina Zuma. He worked under a dozen different names. But Zuma was a Pfeffer creation. And they put him in New York. Well, he really didn't draw that well, but then they brought Rocca back, and they had them work matches against each other that really drew well. And then they brought Apollo in after Zuma left, and Apollo teamed with Rocca for a while, and then Rocca left, and Apollo stayed there probably through the mid-60s, and then he went to, I think he went to Charlotte. And that's where he really started to get over, and then he was in Georgia from there, and then, like Bobby said, he worked for Einhorn, the IWA, and then after that he was pretty much out of it. He was probably in the business less than 15 years. He wasn't in it all that long. I just got a message, Jerry, to ask you about somebody. The Height Sisters in Kansas City, Murdy and Gertie. Did you ever have
any
dealings with them or know about them?
I knew about them. Yes, still got pictures of them.
They probably
the twins.
That's probably who bought all your T-shirts.
I wouldn't doubt it. They were some of the cutest things I've ever seen. I mean, they were precious. I wish I had all the finishes they had ever seen. They were there every week, and they were on up there when we were out there. I mean, they were there every week, identical twins.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Were they Bulldog Bob Brown fans?
Oh, yeah, they love Bulldogs.
Oh, man. All right, the next guy Don't know if either one of you ever worked with him. Jerry, you might have in Florida, because you might have crossed paths with him in Florida. Bobby, you probably saw him. But I think he was out of Georgia by the time you got in the business. May have come back a time or two, and that's Tarzan Tyler.
Worked with Tyler.
Did you?
He...
Was it...
He was here when the split happened, Bobby, or what's going on?
He came in after the split, but he came in and worked for Ann. I was in the ring with, I refereed a few matches of his. I'll never forget the first time I saw him.
Wait a minute, Bobby. Wait a minute now. Wait a minute.
I
know he was with this office, the Georgia office, when that split happened.
Well, he may have left, but he came back because he worked for Ann.
He may have left and come back because I had words with him in Atlanta when Lester Welch was running things.
Yeah.
Yeah, I saw the handwriting on the wall. I'd only been in business 2 years, and I knew what was going on. They were trying to steal Savannah. And so I told them, I said, what they were doing, they would put me on TV in Atlanta and beat me on Atlanta TV and put me on the main event in Savannah with Tarzan Tyler.
Yeah.
And I told them, I said, y'all must think I'm a fool. I said, y'all think I'm crazy? I said, I know I've only been in the business 2 years. I said, I don't know what's going on. Eddie Graham got the word. So he got me in at the auditorium in Atlanta. I always liked Eddie because, you know, I started down there, and I was like,
yeah.
Eddie, man, he said, yeah, he said, I told Ralph about it too, Ralph Reed. I said, y'all think I'm an idiot. I said, I know what's going on. I said, there's nothing but a bunch of thieves up here, man. And it was, I'm telling you.
Yeah.
Because I got caught up in it. And, you got that wrong. I said, you think I'm crazy? You beat me on two tapes in Atlanta and put me on the main event week after week with Tarzan Tyler? Yeah, that crew that had this office in, I got my own opinion about them.
Yeah, I understand.
That's all I'm going to say.
Well,
all
they had...
All I'm going to say is, I don't blame that crew. I'm talking about Tom Ernesto and that whole crew for doing what they did.
If they had treated Ann like they should have, that split would have never happened.
Let me tell you something. That was the lowest down thing I have ever heard. I was working for. See, I start getting mad about all this stuff. I was working for.
You were in Montgomery, weren't you?
That's exactly where I was, and I already got a starting date, but the split hadn't come yet. Already got a starting date, so it was. I'm coming in like 2 weeks back to Georgia. Well, that gum split happens like just a few days before I come, and I called and got my bookings. Well, I went with Ann, you know, because I that's all I knew. Nobody told me any different. Well, anyhow, I went back with this office because Mr. Newman went with Ann, and then I think Mr. Ward then talked him into going back, which he did, and hell, I'm caught in a trick now, right?
Yeah.
So I got to go back. And then that's when they brought Ted in, and he comes with Ann. So you're right, Bobby Simmons. You're one of the few people I've ever heard actually say the truth, and that was the truth, what you said.
Yeah, if they had just, you know, I mean, Ray owned 51% of this promotion here, at least 51. I'm not sure what the actual split was, but he was the majority stockholder. He had to say so. And when he died, Ann inherited it. That made her the boss.
I don't know how they did what they did. I don't know how they did it.
Well.
Who brought this up? I won't sleep half the night now.
Tarzan Tyler did.
Anyway, back to Tarzan Tyler. The first time I ever met him, and I'll never forget it. I had seen him wrestle, but I'd never been close to him or been around him. The first night I met him was a Monday night in Columbus, Georgia. Dick was promoting, and he ran. We were running that football stadium, Memorial Stadium, and the heels had to dress at the far end of the football field. You had to walk 100 yards to get to the ring. And he started across that football field. And Dick got the microphone. I don't remember who was doing the ring announcement, but Dick took the microphone, and, you know, Dick could sell Eskimo snowshoes. And he started talking about it. He said, ladies and gentlemen, coming across this field right now is one of the most, if not the most dangerous individual in the wrestling business today. And, son, the closer he got, the bigger he looked.
He was
and the sucker
monster.
Always had a tan, always had the hair dyed blonde.
Was his hair combed perfect, man?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And wore him, looked like a checkerboard, but there was pink and green and all different colored trunks, and he wore pink boots with that tan.
Yep.
Son, he was a machine. And I don't remember who they had him working with now, but he just got in there and ate him up. But it was, I had the chance to be in a ring with him a few times. He was one of those guys sort of like Jerry Graham. He had a natural charisma that people, when they looked at him, wanted to kill him.
Well, I'm glad somebody's on this program besides me that knows the real story. See, somebody call in and say something different, that ain't going to float here, because you know Bobby and I know.
Yep.
You lived it. I lived it.
Well, I had the privilege, and I call it a privilege because I was very honored that they asked me. When Lester Welch died about 3, 4, 5 years ago, I'm not sure how long ago it was now, I got a phone call from Jackie Welch. And Jackie asked me if I would come to Pensacola and conduct a memorial service for his dad. And I did. And I went down, and I was very honored that I was asked to do it, and I was very honored to speak at Lester's funeral. And I had gotten to know Lester a little bit through the reunion. Of course, Lester was way up in years, and, you know, he didn't remember like he used to either. But, yeah, you know, when just say this, when that Tennessee bunch would get together, somebody was going to get ripped off.
Well,
and it wasn't Tennessee bunch.
Well, just like Bob Boyer told me, you know where the word Welch comes from, don't you? The Welch on a deal.
It was, I mean, that's all I'm going to say.
All right, well, I'm going to throw another name out.
It was what it was, and it's over, and we can't change it, so.
Yep. And look at it this way, Jerry. They're all dead and gone and died, you know, not knowing who they were, and you're still in good health.
Well, that's true, too. But, you know, I don't wish anything bad on anybody. But I just hate seeing. And that woman wound up losing everything she had on account of these people. And, you know, it just, anyhow. Who's the next person?
Guy who was never a great big name in Georgia, but he was part of the show and did his part. And was a good worker. And Jerry, you may have had something to do with training this guy, Bobby Garrett.
Had nothing to do with Bobby Garrett, but Bobby. Bobby, did he work many house shows?
Yeah, he worked a few. Real name's Fred Garrett. Lives in Macon, Georgia. Still there.
Liked Bobby.
Yep. Good little hand. Could have made some money in his business. He didn't want to travel.
No. He would come over to the shop over and work for Fuller periodically, either under Hood or as himself, but just do one or two shots here. What did he do outside the business, Bobby, as a living,
You know, I'm not sure. He had a job there in Macon, and he...
He worked at a parts place or something,
yeah,
Bobby.
Yeah, that sounds right. So I want to say...
I think I'm right on that.
Yeah, that sounds right. But he was.
Flair broke his arm.
Who did?
Yeah, Flair. Yeah.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah.
And Flair took care of him. He told me.
Yeah, he did. He did. You know. He took care of all of his medical. I mean, it was nothing Flair did on purpose. He took him
to
that vertical suplex.
No, I'm not saying that.
And when they fell backwards, Bobby just was out of position, and he broke his feet. What was it, the ulna, the upper arm part between the bone between the shoulder blade and elbow. And
Bobby was a good guy.
Was a good worker. Good worker.
The last time I saw him was at, I don't know how long ago this has been, but Jerry, you were there. Remember the deal we did, they had for two at that Hooters there in Macon?
Oh, absolutely, for Ted.
Yeah. He come in that night, and that's the first time, that's the last time I saw him. But he looked exactly
the same.
Was he
there, really?
Yeah, he looked exactly the same.
I got pictures of that.
I've got pictures of that night, and I look at all the people that were there that night, man. It's hard to believe how many of them are gone. Scarpa was there that night.
I don't know if I've got pictures of everybody, Bobby, but I have them on my computer.
I got a bunch of them in my photo album back here. Scarpa was there. Daryl Cochran was there. Rocket was there. God, I can't remember who else was there. There was a bunch of folks.
Wasn't Thunderbolt there?
I
didn't go to that one. That was before we started doing the regular get-togethers in Georgia.
I can't remember.
I don't think
No, it don't seem like he was there. This was a thing Ben Masters threw for John.
Oh, okay. I'm thinking it was the first get-together
No, first get-together we had was at a Ryan Steakhouse in Conyers.
Okay.
But yeah, that was a nice little get together that Ben threw for him that night. There was a bunch of folks there.
It really was.
Yeah, that was the first night I met your son. That's the night I met Bo that night. That's the first time I'd ever met him.
Yeah, he was there.
Yeah.
Yep, he was there.
Yeah.
All right. Next name. Bolo Mongol, mass superstar, Billy Eady, whatever you want to call him.
Very good worker.
Yes.
Super nice guy. I never heard anybody say a bad word about him.
Yeah.
Ever. Ever. I really like Bill. When I was running, he would come down for me, you know. Never had to worry about him, you know. You don't have to worry about what kind of shape. I don't mean physically shape. You know, other shape he'd be in. You know, he's always, you know, always straight. Just pleasure to have around, pleasure to do business with.
And he still works every once in a while.
Yep.
I'm still waiting for the rematch between. Oh, he was your tag team partner, wasn't he? Or no, it was you and Ted against him and Ted Allen, the last match you worked. Or was it you and Bo? I don't remember what your last match was, Derek. But wasn't Eady involved in it somewhere?
My last match?
What am I thinking of? No, I'm thinking of one that it was you against him and Charlie Smith was the referee.
Yeah, that was in Columbus, Mosley.
Charlie Smith tells a funny story, Michael, about him, Jerry and Ted were going to work with Bill and Ted Allen in a tag match there when they were running Columbus. And he said, of course, I never went up there, but Charlie said they used to get in a little closet or something when they would talk about the finishes. And so they got in the closet and said, Jerry told them, said, we're going to go an hour Broadway. And said, nobody in the closet said anything. And said, somebody said, is there anybody here don't think they can do an hour? And they said, Bill's hand went up, Charlie's hand went up, Ted's hand went up, Jerry's hand went up.
Oh.
Just sitting here in this recliner an hour seems like an awful long time some nights.
Don't it?
God.
Well, I was never asked to do an hour Broadway, and I don't know that I could have back even then, and I was only 195 pounds. But I can
it's not what you think. It's not what you think. I know Bobby's refereed him in the other one.
Oh, jeez.
It's not what you think.
It wasn't nothing to lose 10 or 11 pounds in an hour, refereeing. I don't know what the guys lost.
It's not what you think. It's hours, a long time.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure. And then if you got somebody in there that you're working with.
But back then, you know, you was in shape and you really didn't think nothing about it.
No, you didn't.
I mean, you just, okay, I'm not going to go 35 or 40 tonight, go on an hour. Okay. But, you know, I didn't mind it.
You know, I mean, I wasn't taking the bumps the guys were taking. But on those nights, you know, these guys, you know, you go to an independent show now, they'll have six matches with 12 or 14 guys, and they'll have seven, eight different referees. They'll work one match apiece. On those nights Jerry's talking about, I'd referee every match on the card.
Oh, absolutely.
And then take a 10-minute intermission and then go in the ring, go an hour.
Yeah, see, and people didn't think about all that.
No,
that
and,
no
I, and I, when I refereed, I didn't stand in the corner. You know, I was up and down with the guys, or I tried to be, and
you was always as busy as the guys, Bobby.
It was, those were some long nights.
I can imagine. You know, that's what used to marvel me about Ron West, because Ron was always, he just had so much natural energy. You know, he could work a whole card like that, and he was constantly moving. If you've ever seen, of course, Jerry working a match, you may not have ever noticed it. But Ronnie, when guys were working on the mat, Ronnie would back off, put his hand on the top rope and stand there and dance. He'd walk back and forth and kick his feet. He was perpetual motion all the time.
And, you know, like Bobby was never in your way. Ronnie was never in your way, you know. Always at the right place at the right time.
Well, one thing Ronnie taught me, and a lot of guys, and here again, guys, of course, they don't have to do it anymore. But in a match like that where you got a guy going an hour or 90 minutes or whatever they were doing, you know, they would eventually, they'd do a high spot or two, but eventually they'd go back to a hold and get out on the mat.
Mm-hmm.
And that way they could catch
right.
their breath. They didn't kill themselves. Well, as a referee, you know, you got to do something. So I learned. I'd get flat on my stomach, and I would lay there like I was checking shoulders or checking for a choke. And I was doing the same thing they were doing. And
you
by getting down on
the
mat,
you're not
in anybody's way. You know, the fans aren't screaming at you to keep moving. You're down there, and you actually look like you're doing something. And but once you learn to do that, you paced yourself like they did. And
you were hunting air like we were, Bobby. That's what you were doing.
Whew. Yeah, you ain't kidding.
This is a little off the subject, but can you guys think of any other territory that had as many good referees as Georgia had? When Ronnie, Bobby,
no.
and Charlie, and the other Smith,
no.
Doug, and Eddie, Scrappy, Nick.
No.
It's amazing. The talent that, I mean, and a lot of people don't, you know, they watch a match and they don't even notice the referee, which is,
you know,
you're
doing
your job. The referee's not supposed to be noticed, but you look at, you know, that takes a lot of work to not be noticed, if that makes any sense to you, as far as
the
referees go.
Not because I'm from Georgia, but year in and year out, this state had, we didn't have to back up to anybody's talent. Nobody's talent.
Not at all.
Not year in, year out. I mean, I believe that. I'm not saying other places, you know, the Carolinas always had good talent. Florida, you know, but there's some talent come through here.
Absolutely. Especially after the TBS kicked off on Super Channel. Everybody wanted to be there. Everybody wanted to work in Georgia. You know, guys, top guys from other territories wanted to be on that TV, even if it was for one or two matches. But back to Bill Eadie, the most amazing thing to me about Bill Eadie's career is he went from being Bolo Mongol to being the mass superstar literally overnight. And
nobody
ever caught on.
Nobody knew it.
And he, to me, and I don't know if how you guys think about it, but he, to me, is probably one of the top 10 interviewers or interviews ever. He was in that Tom Ernesto, Jody Hamilton, Buddy Colt you know, frame.
He was very good.
But he was always calm and collected, but made his point, and you know, he said something, you felt like he meant it, you know. And
Bill was such a nice man. He was, just a sweetheart of a guy. Just, you love to be around him and sit and talk to him, you know.
Yeah.
Yep.
I first met him when he was doing the Mongol thing. And I know I've told this before, but he was the one that, when Ron Hill and Apollo got into it in Atlanta that night, he's the one that run down the corner to me and went, jump in between them. And I remember looking at him and telling him, I said, pal, if you want somebody to get between them, I suggest you climb in here. I'm going to stand right here in this corner. Truth be known, I didn't like either one of them that much, and I was kind of hoping they'd kill each other and that'd been the end of it. But, you know, I think one was scared and the other one was glad of it, and they just, you know.
All right.
I'm sure I've told this. Did I tell you the tale about what Bill told me his introduction to the wrestling business was on Pittsburgh TV?
Mm-mm.
You told me. Go ahead and tell it again.
They had to go 2 out of 3 falls on Pittsburgh TV, and he said they went to the dressing room between falls. And he said the first fall of the match, they're working with somebody, and they're just putting the boots to this guy, and some guy on the front row has a heart attack and dies. He said they finish the fall and they go to the dressing room, and he said they hold them back there for 15, 20 minutes while the ambulance in the corner or whoever, whatever they had to do, they haul this guy out. I mean, covered, he dead, graveyard dead. He said he'd come back out for the second fall, and he said the guy's family is still sitting on the front row.
Come on, man.
So it was. He said they told the cops, we ain't leaving until we see the end of this match.
Well, that guy was, he couldn't do nothing about it.
Wasn't nothing they could do about it, I don't guess. So. He said that was his introduction to the wrestling business.
He just knew he had to be a part of this.
All right, next name. Doug Gilbert, the professional.
I'll leave this one to Jerry. I never met him.
You didn't, Bobby?
Never met him. We never crossed paths. I saw him work a lot of times, but I never met him.
I first saw him in Columbus. He was here as a professional, and Ted and I, was I still in high school? I might have been in high school and just got out. So Ted and I, we were down at the matches in Columbus, and We looked at him for a couple of weeks, and we finally figured out who he was. Because him and Dickie were partners up in Minneapolis.
Right, right.
And so we said, that's Doug Gilbert. You know how we knew? How do you think we knew that Doug Gilbert? The veins are going across his chest.
Oh, really?
So we walked up to him. He was a heel. We walked up to him one night, and we told him, we said, we're Dick Steinborn's brother-in-law. So we got pictures of, you know, magazine. Yeah, we had magazines, but what's that thing Charlie makes so much about? Programs.
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 Yeah, so we got programs from up there when you and Dickie were partners. And he, you know. He was nice. But then he came back as one of the Infernos.
Yep.
With J.C. and...
Curtis Smith.
Exactly.
Yep.
Doug could do a lot of stuff in that ring. Doug was a nice guy. I really like Doug. You know, I haven't heard anything about him forever.
He's in, I want to say Nebraska, Omaha or somewhere
that's,
like that.
That's what I heard, Mike. But you never met him, Bobby?
Never did. I can remember as a kid, I said, you know, I was in school, you know, going to the auditorium watching. I seen a lot of guys do a lot of things off the top rope. But it's kind of impressive to see a 265-pound guy do that backflip off that top rope and land flat on his feet.
Doug was a big man, son. Doug was big. What a pleasure to work with. Oh. It's not what you thought. I mean, it was unbelievable.
Last time I saw him, he was refereeing for Vern. I saw him on a tape. I saw him on a tape.
Well, I mean, no.
Yeah, I never got to see him as a professional. The first time I ever saw him work, he was in Florida as Redbeard. And he was part of Bobby Shane's clique. And he had that wild red afro and beard and everything. Wrestled barefooted. He was like a wild man.
Did he really?
I think he started off there as the professional and then got unmasked or whatever. But it was he and Bobby Shane and a guy by the name of Mike Webster, who was a Canadian football player that wrestled for a few years. They were, in fact, I think Gilbert and Webster were the Florida Tag Team Champions for a while or something. But that's where I first saw him. Since then, I've seen tape of him as a professional, and Bobby's right. For somebody that was as big as he was, of course, I, you know, grew up watching, you know, the Mobile territory, and we didn't have big guys like that. The biggest guy we had was Rip Tyler, and he was about 245, 250 pounds. But to see somebody Gilbert size doing head scissors and drop kicks and...
he could do it all, man. He can do it all.
Off the top rope. And that brings us to our next name. There's another big guy that impressed me doing head scissors and drop kicks and stuff like that. It's Jody Hamilton. Jody was amazing. I hate that I never got to see the original Assassins in their prime. I saw Jody with Roger Kerb, Roger Smith, and saw Jody with Randy Colley, but never saw
him
in
the same.
It wasn't.
I mean, not knocking the other guys, but, you know, it just, the time, I mean, Jody, yeah, good God. He put both feet right upside your head.
Tom and Jody thought alike. That's what made them click. I mean, you know, there was very little conversation between the two during a match. It was instinctive.
They were the masters, but you know, it was them and then there's the rest. They were unbelievable. Yeah, but Jody, he could. Good Lord. Strong, good Lord. He'd beat you to death in that ring. Clowning, you know.
Did he ever pinch you under your arm?
Yeah, he did everything to me, Bobby Simmons.
I used to stay black and blue from my shoulder to my elbow. Because if he pinched you, when he would pinch you under the arm, he was so strong, you couldn't get away from him. And
you
I mean,
think
he
a,
would
the
just
plug out of
light it. You up.
Who was tougher to work with in the ring between he and his brother Larry?
You know,
did
I've
you
never
work with Mahler? Really?
Never worked with him. Did you, Bobby?
Never worked with him. Larry Hamilton's the only guy I was ever afraid of. He was the only guy that I
was
literally scared
man.
Of. But they were totally different. Two totally different styles, Michael. I mean, they were Jody smooth as glass, and Larry was a little rough around the edges the way he worked. But he was, it was two totally different styles.
Yeah.
You talking
I
about Jody and those drop kicks? To watch him and Soto exchange flying head scissors was always amazing to me.
Wow, I can imagine
for a guy that big to get up. And son, he could sure get up there.
Oh, he could now.
Well, Soto and Bill Bowman talks about this all the time, when the two of them together. Soto threw the most beautiful drop kick.
There's no doubt about that.
I've got pictures of Soto working with Joe and Bill when they were the interns in Mobile. And I bet Soto and Ramon Perez worked 1,000 matches between them and Bill and Joe. And always great matches from what
the
Bill's doing.
You, I'm kidding, too.
Yeah. For a little guy, I mean, he was a little bitty guy.
He was tight. Could work, though, my God.
Oh, yeah, he was a fantastic worker.
Oh, he was unbelievable. But, yeah, what did he weigh? $1.55, maybe?
Maybe.
Did you know him, Bobby?
No, never met him.
Oh, God. It's a shame he wasn't bigger. That boy, I'm telling you. I don't know who trained him, but I'm telling you, that boy, he was like a cat.
He came out of that school that Rocker ran in New York.
Is that right?
Yeah, and I think, I'm not sure if he worked with Sanazaro or Gene or Tony Santos in Boston or not. I'll have to ask. I know Roberto worked there. I know Roberto's real brother, Manny, worked there, but I'm not sure if that's where Ramon ever worked up there or not. He and Soto, they put them together in Louisiana when Lee was running Louisiana. Soto came in first, and he was using the name that he was using in Boston, which is Pepe Perez. And then Ramon had been in before as Ramon Lopez, but then they brought him in and teamed he and Soto up as the Perez brothers. And like I said, they had a good 2 or 3 year run there. And they were both just kids. I mean, Soto was about 17, and Ramon was 19, maybe 20.
Ramon and, was one of those, what you call just a natural.
Yep.
He was a natural. He was phenomenal.
And Jerry,
but he was always that small.
Yeah. Yeah. He was always, every time
him,
I saw him.
When I met him, Mike, he had a bad drinking problem.
Oh, yeah. That's what he had. He had the whole time he and Soto were together.
He could still work, though.
I met his, I didn't physically meet, but just through emails. I traded emails back and forth with his nephew several years ago. He was looking for pictures of Ramon and information, but he told me he died of cirrhosis of the liver. And he was, I don't even think he lived to be 40. But
what a waste.
After he left Golden, I guess he stayed with Golden until they went out of business. And after that, I don't know whatever became of him. I know he worked in Tennessee for a while.
I never heard of him after that, Mike. After I left, Ted left. He was still there when we left. When I come back to Georgia and Ted, followed, but he went with Dunkel, and we never heard from him again.
Hmm. He was definitely a great worker.
I wish you could
see Roberto. Roberto hadn't changed a bit. He's a little smaller,
really?
But still in great shape. Still in great shape. It still doesn't take much to get to set him off. Which is every time I'm around him, that's my goal. I see how quick I can get him mad.
He sent me a picture. He sent me a picture the other day. If I say this name, Jerry may know who I'm talking about. Do you remember a young lady in Savannah that they call Big Linda?
Please.
Okay. He sent me a picture. He sent me a picture the other day of this woman, and she probably weighed about 450, and she had on a pair of jeans, and she was squatting down, and you could tell from the back of the picture that she had on a pair of thong underwear. And the caption he wrote under it, and I'm not going to tell you who it is because some of their family may be listening, it says, "Such and such is girlfriend from Savannah, Big Linda." And I seen that thing at work, and I just fell out. Because
yeah,
I know this
her.
Person that he mentioned, I know that they had a kind of a going thing there for a while.
Oh, I know who you're talking. Oh, I know.
Used to throw chops.
Yes, sir. He threw a few in the sun, and we need to leave it at that. You know, I ask about her since I've been moved here. Nobody knows. And the other one, what was the other one's famous one from Savannah?
I do not know.
You remember both?
Nope.
Savannah
Jackie. Is that the one you're talking about?
Yeah, Savannah Jackie.
Yeah.
Yep. One of the famous masked men supposedly had a child by her. But we had a lot of masked men here.
Yeah, we did.
I'm going to leave it at that.
Oh, man.
We need an X-rated show.
I heard that.
Well, when we finally decide to give it up, our last show, we'll just let it off.
Yeah, we'll just have at it.
Yeah. But, yeah, there was you were talking about Murdy and Gertie. I was thinking about two that used to sit on the front row in Atlanta that I call Heckle and Jekyll.
Oh, Lord.
You better go to another name, Michael.
Actually, I'm at the end of the list.
Oh, you're at the end of the list. Okay.
I'm at the end of the list.
We might dig something up on this fella, but go ahead.
Well, we can mention a belated happy birthday to Scott Teal. We missed it last week.
Happy birthday,
Scott
Teal.
Scott hit the big 6-0.
He did not.
Yes, sir. 60 years old. He don't
he
look
flat,
it, does he?
Look, he looks fantastic.
We were the Friday night of the get-together there in Nashville. His wife surprised him with a little surprise birthday party with all of us there, and she said it was early, but she said they can't think, there's nobody else he'd rather spend his birthday with. So it was just she had this little game where had a bunch of questions about Scott. Some of them I knew and some of them I didn't. But we had a fun time. But it was, he turned, I think it was the 9th. He turned 60
really
years
good.
Old. Yes, he does.
He really looks good.
He's planning on retiring from UPS, not this December, but next December, 2014.
Wow. Well, good. Congratulations to him.
Yeah.
Hopefully he'll get back to putting out some more books, because I tell you, and I'm not saying this because Scott's a friend of mine, but Scott Teal does the best wrestling books of anybody I've ever read books on. His book with Jody, his book with Ole, and probably my favorite is his book with Jim Dillon. Best books I've ever read wrestling about the wrestling business. A lot of people may not believe that or agree with that, but those are the three best, and the common denominator is Scott Teal and all of them.
Yeah, Scott does a good job. I think that's his goal. I think he wants to write full time. I think he wants to dedicate himself to doing more of that stuff. So
good. He certainly
Who's the last one, Mike?
Well, we did go to him. So let me think of another one real quick that I haven't put on here. Let's talk about Wahoo.
We ain't got enough time. Wahoo. He was a special guy. Tough. He was a tough son of a gun. And yep. You know, if you didn't like Wahoo, there's something wrong with you.
He certainly made his matches believable. He made a believer out of me first time he chopped me.
Oh,
I think I
never
had the
had
handprint
that
for a week.
I never had the handprint
on my chest for a week. But,
yeah, I never met anybody that had any problem selling them chops.
You know, those kind
you
of
gonna,
chops, they hurt so bad
fall
you can't hurt them, sell them. It's hard to sell them, it hurts so bad.
Oh, yeah.
You just want to sit down and cry.
Sometimes when you get hit, when you get so hard, you don't react to it. You know,
yeah,
you just kind of.
It's like, this just didn't happen to me.
Yeah.
It couldn't have. I'm still breathing, right?
Yeah. Now, what you do, you question yourself. I actually stood here and and let him do this to me.
What's wrong with that picture, right?
Did you guys ever witness in person or have seen videotape of matches between he and Johnny Valentine?
No.
I don't think
I'm surprised the ring wasn't hurt the way those two went at each other. I mean, there's no way you could watch the two of them and think, as a fan, and think, this is real.
It'll work, right? Well, let me tell you, that Wahoo, I mean, he was, man.
Michael, I'll tell you another guy like that. That's Eddie Graham.
Yeah.
Eddie Graham will tell you. Lay him in, kid.
He was tough.
Had the best. I don't know. I never worked with him, but he threw that little short jab. He'd hold you in a headlock and throw that little short jab, kind of like what Rocket used to do, and it just looked like it hurt. And Gordon Sully used to sell it. He was the hardest puncher in wrestling, and you had no problem believing it after sitting there watching him throw him. That's another one that I wish I'd seen live in their prime, was he and Jerry together. I've seen videotape of them, and I can just imagine what the two of them were like working.
Yeah, they said Graham, Jerry was a heck of a worker at one time.
He was a heck of a worker even after he got up over 400 pounds. He just, you know, he couldn't do as much physically, but he had the psychology. Like Bobby said, you know, he was one of those that would walk into an arena or a bar or a nightclub or anywhere else, and you just instantly hated him.
Yeah, you wanted to kill him. And then you got to know him, and you really wanted to kill him.
There you go. Topped it off. That's a shame.
Well, I'll throw one more out real quick, because I don't know. Bobby, I know you met him, saw him a lot as a kid. Jerry, I don't know if you ever worked any cards with him or ever worked with him. Freddie Blassie.
I was around him. Never worked with him, no. But when I first started, he would come in. You know, I'd use, you know, just see him in Atlanta.
How over was he in Atlanta? I know he was hated.
In the early 60s, late 50s,
yeah.
Early 60s. He was as hated as anybody that's ever been. Him and Gunkel had a running thing, had a sort of like a Soto Spears thing.
Yeah.
I mean, it was. I remember my uncle told me about it. He said when he got home from the Army in 1959, he went to their matches, and then after I started going, he started taking me, and I think I started in 64. He said that, you know, he told me, he said, man, he said that was some of the darndest things he'd ever seen. Yeah, I only met him one time. He came in, he was managing somebody, and it might have been Volkov, and they came in for an Omni card, and he got to the Omni early, about 6:30, and somebody told me he was there, and I went out of the office, and I went over, and I just went over and introduced myself and told him. I said, look, I'm not being cute, you know, or funny, because a lot of guys thought you was trying to be smart with him. I said, look, I watched you as a kid. And I said, I was as afraid of you as I was a gun. And I said, I just wanted to come over and introduce myself to you and talk to you. And I sat there and talked with him for 2 hours.
He was a nice guy.
Super nice guy.
You were talking about Tarzan Tyler. There's another one. Always tan. Always had that perfect hair.
Immaculate.
Always dressed immaculate.
I don't know how those guys kept those tans back then. There were no sunbeds and all that crap.
Oh, yeah. And another thing.
Oh, how did it?
I don't know how they afforded all the outfits they had. Blassie, you never saw him wear the same thing twice, Harvey.
Yeah,
he always
had
boots that matched his trunks and his jacket, and you know.
Yep.
Of course, boots were $10 a pair or $8 a pair at Hildegard back then. But these guys weren't wearing Hildegard boots.
No. Ooh. All right, well, guys, we are just about out of time. I do want to, for anybody that is circus fans, one of our high wire girls fell off the high wire last night in Slidell, Louisiana, and suffered at least, from what I understand, a dislocated shoulder and a broken arm. I don't know.
Oh,
and they work with the wire, so I don't know why, what happened. The guys in the high wire troop don't wear the wires, but the girls both did. And I don't know if she was just trying to wean herself off the wire or whatever. But and I don't know which is worse, the injury she suffered or having to be in the hospital in Slidell, Louisiana. But her name is Yeesy Tabarez, and they're a fantastic high wire act. And she is certainly going to be missed for the time she's out, but hopefully she'll have a speedy recovery and get back in the act before the season ends. And I think I just want to reach out and wish her the best. And anybody that's circus fans out there or have had the opportunity to see that the Tabarez group work this season, just keep them and her in your thoughts and prayers. And hopefully they'll get her. They've still got another 2 weeks in Louisiana, so hopefully that she'll be recovered well enough to at least get back on the road with the show, even if she's not performing. I would not think she'll be able to perform the rest of the season, but you never know. You never know. But nice young lady. Very sweet girl and everything. And so just everybody keep her in that group in your thoughts and prayers, and I'll keep everybody updated as I hear about things. But anyway, well, this was fun, guys. We'll try something different next week.
This was good, guys.
I tell you what we'll do. I'll come up with a bunch of names and stump you guys with. How about that? Since we used to do that.
That would be hard.
I was fixing to say, it's not hard on this end.
Don't mention no split in Georgia, whatever you do.
Yeah.
Or T-shirts in Kansas City. Or the McGuire
thing.
Your list is, your
up,
list is growing, Jerry.
Our topics are dwindling.
Yeah. Well, it's been great as always, and we'll get together next week, and we'll do it one more time.
Sounds good.
Y'all have a great week.
Have a good week, guys.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
We thank you for listening to this broadcast, a production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com and the GWH Radio Network. Stay tuned to GWH for nostalgia, upcoming events, and more. As always, GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com thanks you for your continued support.